What I wanted to do tonight is to give a talk a little bit about the subject of progress, about the path, and talk more about it because I think it's a very interesting topic. So traditionally, the practice of mindfulness was understood to be part of a path. It was practiced in the context of a path that someone followed, and in which a person made progress, in which a person could speak of progress, progressing along a path. A person who was a beginner, kind of a middling practitioner, and there was an end to the path. You progressed enough and you came to the end, and there was no more path for you, and you had done what had to be done, was the expression. Done what had to be done. And there are many descriptions of paths in Buddhism. You find many path descriptions of how a spiritual journey is supposed to look like. And I think that all of them are meant to be, on one hand, supposed to be encouraging. They're supposed to encourage us in our practice, though a lot of people get discouraged by them because they're not making progress according to the particular path they think they're on. And so they're meant to be encouraging, and they're also meant to be guides, so that we can guide, have some sense of where we're going and how we get there, kind of like the map that we follow as we kind of progress along the way. And all the different models of the path, and there's many of them in Buddhism, they all share this common notion that you can go from one place to another. You can cultivate your mind, your heart, to get from one place to the other. You can go from being less aware to becoming more aware. You can go from being insensitive to becoming sensitive. You can go from being in conflict with yourself, in conflict with the world, to being at peace with yourself and at peace with the world. You can go from being afraid to being unafraid, or to being confident. And these are kind of things that are kind of understood. You can kind of do these things to some degree. And the traditional Buddhist notions of the path is that, yes, indeed, this is what you're supposed to do, is to cultivate and develop this capacity, and these abilities, these potentials. Now, in talking about the path, what I wanted to do was to lay out for you three different kind of models, three kind of categories in which the different models of a path fit into. And these three categories, the first one is the developmental model, where there's actually something to cultivate and you develop something. The second is the model not of cultivating something, but rather the model of letting go, of emptying yourself. And the third model is neither emptying yourself of stuff and not developing certain abilities, but rather the third model of the path is that there's no path. There's no path to follow at all. And the very idea of a path is a delusion. Some people, in some schools of Buddhism, or some teachers will get very adamant about how it's really a delusion to have any kind of idea of progress. And you just free yourself from it, because the more you can be free of any notion of progress, the freer you'll be. You'll make progress. So the developmental, so I want to talk about these three, and then try to offer kind of a synthesis of those three at the end. So the developmental model is the one where you're cultivating certain qualities and abilities, potentials within us. And I forgot to bring it today. I was going to bring with you a little pamphlet I wrote for as a Vipassana student in Grands Fork, North Dakota, who endowed a meditation center at the university there. And she built this little meditation center. And so when it was going to open, she wanted to have a pamphlet describing what meditation is. And she's a Vipassana student, so that was very important for her. But it was meant for a meditation center that anybody in any religion or non-religion could use for their meditation. So she wanted a kind of a pamphlet describing what meditation is in a kind of generic way. And I wrote something like, for her then, that the practice of meditation often is based on the idea that the mind can be developed and the heart can be increasingly opened, increasingly developed. The mind and the heart can be developed. And the idea that the mind can be developed is something that musicians and athletes know quite well, because a lot of them in those kinds of positions are doing things that actually develop their concentration and develop their patience, develop their focus, develop their energy, their stamina. There's many things they develop, and you need to develop these things over time in order to be a good athlete or a good musician or a good artist or just different kinds of professions. You develop certain qualities of mind, certain skills of mind. A friend of mine who's a programmer, either maybe he had before, or because of programming, he developed a lot of concentration. Certain jobs call on certain qualities within us, and as we do them, they become stronger and stronger. And our potential to be more open-hearted, I think, is known by any of us who's ever fallen in love with anybody, with a child or an adult, or anybody who we've had an open, kind of open-hearted kind of feeling towards, of delight and joy. And that, you know, we can feel it comes and goes. There are times in our life when we feel much more open-hearted than other times. It's a potential we have, and that potential to some degree can be opened and developed. People who work for hospices, for example, volunteer in hospice situations, often remark on how much their heart opens and becomes softer and more sensitive and more present. So this idea that the mind and the heart can be developed is not really something that's so foreign or so mystical or so particularly religious. It's just a quality, you know, that the heart and the mind is malleable. It can be developed in all kinds of ways. And we can, you know, the development of the mind, it can be developed both in wholesome and unwholesome directions. So if we spend our times, you know, most of our time going to violent movies and having violent friends and having violent speech, chances are our capacity, our ability, our tendencies towards violence will become stronger and stronger. If we spend our time going to see, you know, peaceful movies, reading nice peaceful books and having peaceful, kind friends and just cultivating peaceful, kind speech, chances are that the kindness within us will become stronger and stronger, more dominant than it would otherwise. Our environment we put ourselves in, the activities we do, can have a huge impact on the qualities of our heart and the qualities of our mind. So the mind can be trained and the heart can be changed. And we can develop strength in discipline, in energy, in courage, in concentration, in mindfulness, in self-knowledge, in patience, in love, in heartfelt openness. All those things can be developed, and there's different kind of range of strengths that those things can have. So the traditional Buddhist idea of a path is for the practitioner to step by step build on these strengths, build on these potentials and these capacities. Because the stronger they get, the stronger they become a foundation for the spiritual life. So some people say they are the definition of the spiritual life. The spiritual life is to become peaceful. The way to become peaceful is to be peaceful. And the more you're peaceful, the more peaceful you become. So you develop this capacity for peace, for generosity, for love, for, you know, a lot of things within us. And as I keep saying, this is one of the most traditional ideas of the path in Buddhism. That the path that we follow is a path of developing and cultivating certain qualities, strengths within us. The word for practice in Buddhism, in Pali, the word is bhavana. And bhavana literally means development or cultivation. It doesn't mean meditation, it just means you're developing and cultivating certain qualities within you. The second kind of general kind of category of paths or path models in Buddhism is the idea that it's not about developing anything, but rather it's about letting go or emptying oneself. And I think there's a word in Christianity for this. I forget, maybe someone knows, some Greek word? No, not catharsis. Anyway. Emptying oneself. So in this case, the path is not about developing qualities, but rather it's removing the barriers within us to peace, to joy, to compassion and wisdom. So we're letting go of our fear, we're letting go of our judgments, we're letting go of our self preoccupations, we're letting go of hate, of ambition, of shyness, of worrying about what other people think about us. We're letting go of the need to have other people like us. This was a very important one for me to discover when I was in the monastery, Tassajara. I was a manager of the kitchen. I was a foreman of the kitchen. And my job was to get the food done and done efficiently and on time. And it was a very difficult job to have if you were very concerned about everybody liking you at the same time. So I got to see the strong tendency I had to want people to like me and how much it was actually a barrier, got in the way. And I got to kind of deal with that. So letting go of the need to have people like you, letting go of the need for security. There's, you know, you can continue the list of things that are a barrier to us feeling content or at ease or at peace in our life. So one of the things we study in this particular path of letting go is what do we hold on to? What are we attached to? What are those barriers that we've created? And why do we think we have to hold on to something? Why are we attached? Why do we cling to things in a way that gets in the way of our living our life fully? Why do we hold on to our self-concept, our self-preoccupation? Why do we hold on to our shyness? Why do we hold on to our ambition or idea of security? You know, I think it's a very interesting question. Why? So, for example, we might hold on to our image, our self-image, and how we look and how other people see us. The clothes we wear, the haircuts we get, and the cars we drive. Because a certain image is cultivated because we think that that's what's needed in order to hold our job. But why do we think we need to hold our job? Because if we can, without a job, we won't have any security. But why do we think we need to have security? Because we fear that if we don't have security, financial security, whatever, we'll become homeless. But why are we afraid of being homeless? Maybe because we're afraid of being of dying. And if you're not afraid of dying, what happens to all the pieces in that progression? If the root of it all is your fear of death and fear of dying, and you've dealt with the fear of death and you have no fear of dying, then perhaps you don't do anything based on the fear of dying, and you don't trying to find security. And since you're not trying to find security, you're not trying to find holding on, you know, tightly or being attached to a job and on and on. So I don't know if that was a good example. But often, if you can start at what you're attached to, what you're holding on, and ask the question, what's behind that? What holding, what clinging is behind that that's holding that in place? And I think often, well, if you do that far enough back, you'll come to a root clinging, a fundamental form of attachment or clinging or holding that's maybe particular for each person, but there's some, you know, generic examples, you know, the fear of death, the fear of pain, the fear of loneliness. There's a fear, and that fear stimulates a certain kind of holding, attachment. And with that basic attachment or fear, we can build a whole edifice, a whole cathedral, a whole big house of personality, of other attachments and going on. So we need to find, so in the path, in this path of letting go, part of the task is to actually try to do the investigation that finds the root holding, the root clinging that our whole life sometimes can be built on. And it's quite wonderful in a sense, to have people enter the path of mindfulness and discover how certain tendencies are so pervasive that they didn't realize before. People who didn't realize that fear was such a pervasive characteristic of everything they do and everything they say and, you know, so much of their life. And you don't really see it sometimes until you do a practice that somehow helps you to get down to the root of your personality. So the ideal model of Buddhist monastics, monks and nuns, is an example of someone who's trusts their life enough that that they're not holding on to many of the things we commonly hold on to. They're called homeless. They don't have homes. They don't have any bank accounts. They don't have any food, which they keep from day to day. Yes?
But they're living in a shelter. They're getting food. They're not living in danger or pain.
Well, if you remember the talk I gave a few months ago about the forest tradition in northeastern Thailand, the monks lived like that, and still do to some degree, not as much as they used to. But they used to go wandering in the forest where there was quite a bit of danger back then, and literally tigers and all kinds of dangerous animals. Or sometimes in just 20 years ago, they put themselves in the middle of places where they were shot at because they were between the communists and the government in Thailand. And you're in a lot of the poor areas of Thailand, and you don't know if you're going to get enough food for that day. I've known people who are monks in northeastern Thailand, and they just got a little bit of rice, because that's all the people there had to give, was a little bit of rice, and it wasn't really enough to sustain them from day to day. If you live in Bangkok, you get fat. But the traditional ideal of a monk, and some people live this way, is really trusting that things will be taken care of. And if they don't, you'll starve. And your reservation is good, but it is an example of someone who's let go, come what may. Probably a better example in the United States is the example of this woman called the Peace Pilgrim. Maybe some of you have read her book. It used to be available for free. Now you can sell it in the books. They sell it in the bookstore. And this is a woman who, about 1950, or during the Korean War, I think, decided to walk across the country for peace. And she never stopped walking. She walked for some 35 years or something. And she, only thing she owned was the clothes she wore. And she wouldn't have any money, and she wouldn't carry any food, and she just had this light tunic that she wore. And for 35 years, she wandered around America, and she didn't have, a monastery, she didn't have lay supporters, she didn't have anything. And she just became such a radiant being that she was inspiration for many, many people. And she found there were times when she was starving and times when she was in the cold and the snow, but somehow she prevailed. And somehow through those 35 years, if she needed new shoes, someone would end up buying her new shoes. And, if it was raining, someone would invite her to stay in her house, or people would feed her. Somehow it was taken care of. So there are examples of this, and whether these are too idealistic, that's for us to decide. But I think it's useful to keep in the back of our mind the model of people who actually can live where they don't hold on to many of the things that we commonly hold on to. And of course, many people in the world can't hold on to those things anyway, because they're living more monastically than the monks, because they're just in poor, destitute situations. And often they live quite happily. I've known people here in the United States who've chosen to be homeless. Not because they were going to be beggars and living off other people, but they chose to be homeless because they felt they could be happier that way. And as far as I could tell, they were pretty happy. So the model of people who don't hold on to the things we commonly hold on to, I think is interesting to keep in mind, because maybe we don't have to hold on to as much as we hold on to. And if we do the work to look back at the root holding, the root fear that stimulates the root holding in our life, and really address that really honestly and completely, we might actually have a different edifice upon which to build our life. And we might make different decisions than we've made right now. So this is one model, the model of letting go. Model of letting go is sometimes the most challenging. The model of developing something, well, that seems safe, You can develop certain qualities, you get better and better at it, and that seems great, right? But the model of letting go, that seems frightening. So the path of letting go of all the barriers to freedom, to love, to joy. In this particular model, the meditation hall is sometimes called the garbage dump, because you come to meditate in order to kind of confront yourself, to see what you're holding onto, and then letting go of it. And so this is just the biggest garbage dump around. And somewhat in a similar vein, the Tibetan teacher Trungpa, who often had these wonderful ways of explaining the teachings, he said, the meditative path is one insult after another. And I think, again, he's talking about this from the letting go model. You confront yourself and you confront things that are quite painful to see about yourself. And you let go. The third model is that there's no path at all. And maybe it's good I waited to the end to talk about that. Now you can all breathe deeply and decide, well, that's where I'm at. I'm not going to develop anything, and I'm certainly not going to let go of anything. And it can also be a relief, because the notion of progress is very can be very oppressive to people. We have people in our society who the idea of measuring ourselves against some kind of standard just feeds into our neurosis, feeds into our feeling bad about ourselves already, that we're not good enough. And so you come to a Buddhist practice that says, well, develop these things, and it doesn't happen. It just, oh, just proves the fact that I'm completely inadequate and unworthy and terrible and bad and, you know, unlovable and all those things. However, the path, so the idea of a path can be oppressive for some people. For other people, it's quite exciting and encouraging because, wow, it's something I can do, and I've met people who've done it, and so I can do that too, and let's do it, let's get going. And they throw themselves in wholeheartedly. So there's different models. When I first started Buddhist practice, I could not have followed the path, the developmental model. I wouldn't have done Buddhism if I thought the practice was about developing something. It would just, you know, got in the way, and I thought it was actually lacked a certain kind of integrity for me personally. And so I did another practice for many, many years, more the emptying practice or the no practice practice. No path practice. Anyway, it's a no path. And the path that there's no path, if you can say that, the idea of a no path is a quite powerful one, a compelling one, and one that it reappears in Buddhism over and over again, because it partly arises out of the vision that a person has when they become enlightened. When you become enlightened, you realize that there's nothing to gain and nowhere to go. And you never really went anywhere, you never came from anywhere. And the whole idea, you thought you were doing the developmental path for years and years, and you thought you kind of things were progressing quite nicely. And then from the vision, from the view of your enlightened state, you look back and say, oh, I was really deluded, I was already there. I had nowhere to go, it wasn't really necessary to do anything at all. The idea of the innate, some people then talk about the innate perfection of life as it is right now. That there is nothing, the very idea is you have to kind of get somewhere to discover your presence, to discover the fullness of this present moment is a delusion, because it's right here, right now. And so the no path one kind of overshadows a little bit with, overlaps a little bit with the letting go model. But even letting go is too late, they say. If you think you have to let go of something, you've misunderstood the perfection's already here. Even your attachment fits into the perfection. If you think you have to let go of your attachment, it just gets, you know, it's a delusion. And it's very powerful, this, because it seems to be the vision that many people report comes with their enlightenment experience. And then you might say, well, it's good for them. They followed all that path of progress for many years. There's a law of the conservation of energy, right, in physics. In spirituality, there's a law of the conservation of perfection. Perfection or reality isn't diminished or gained upon from one moment to the next. It's always the same, the conservation of perfection. And that's a very challenging statement, because life is full of sorrow and tragedy, and how can that fit into that kind of view of perfection that's already here? The path, the no path, the idea of a no path, is seeing oneself and seeing the reality we live in without reference to comparative thinking, without reference to many of the social conventions we have established in order to be able to communicate with each other. Now, there's a lot of conventions that we lay on top of reality. And maybe a good example is the conventions of tall and short. You might see a tree, and the tree is just a tree. It's happy there. It's standing there in the sun, and, you know, it's doing what it's doing, and it's never thought about itself before, and you know, or compared itself to any other tree in anywhere before. It's just kind of happy there, photosynthesizing. And here, the humans come along and say, well, that's a short tree. What do you mean I'm a short tree? I'm just a tree doing what trees do. But we, you know, can compare. There's a tree growing next to it, which is taller, and so we say, well, that's a tall tree and that's a short tree. But there might be a tree that's even shorter than it. And if you compare those, and this one's tall and that one's short. So the idea of tall and short doesn't exist in the thing itself, but rather arises as a convention when we look and make the measurements, do the comparisons. And there's a lot of things like this. A lot of our thinking in life, our understanding of reality, has a lot to do with comparative thinking, which is an overlay on what reality really is, big and small, tall, you know, I can't think of some, but you know, that's all we do. Age is a good one. Many of us, you know, get concerned about our age, various points in our life, all points of our life. It's never quite right. But age is primarily a kind of a comparative thinking also. In the moment of being alive, of sitting here, of going through our life, we're just living. It's life being lived through us. And there's no space to think about age. Age doesn't make any sense in the moment-to-moment living of our life fully. It's like this wonderful thing, if I can kind of convey it, of our face. You know, if we're really involved in a conversation, really involved in not reflecting upon ourselves, our face doesn't exist. Does it? Where do you find your face? And when you're really involved in your life and busy and all that and engaged, to be involved, to know you have a face, you have to reflect back and think about your face or look at yourself in the mirror. But in the moment to moment, a face doesn't exist. You're just kind of living your life fully. The same thing with our age. If we're living our age, our life fully and really present, what does it matter if we're 30 or 40 or 60 or 80? You know, just this is what's going on. But then we start comparing ourselves and thinking, you know, oh, I'm 80 and means I only have a few more years probably, and that means something. And then we head into reflective thinking, and then we feel bad or whatever we feel. To see reality without any reference to any comparative thinking is a very powerful thing. And then the idea of following a path of progression involves using comparative thinking. Today I was 2% concentrated. Tomorrow I hope to be 4% concentrated. And next week I hope to be 10% concentrated. You know, in the moment you are what you are. Who cares about yesterday and today? It's a very powerful way of living, not to be involved in comparative thinking. Not to be involved in ideas of success and failure. So no path is also then without any reference to an ego, since much of our self-identity is based on comparisons. This is a very interesting statement, that much of the way in which we think about ourselves is based on comparative thinking. And if we weren't busy comparatively thinking, what becomes to us? What becomes to ourself, our idea about ourself? Our idea of ourself, much of it would just vanish if we weren't involved in comparative thinking. Comparing ourselves against other people who are better or worse than us or whatever, or some external standard that we think we have to measure up to. Now, the conventions that we use for our communication are needed in order to have society, but they can also become traps. It's useful to say tall and short. If you want that tree moved, and you say take the short tree, hopefully they understand you and don't take the tall tree. So it's useful, but it can also be a trap when we start living only in the world of comparisons and not in the direct experience of what's really there, in the treeness of this moment, in the humanness of this moment, not in the humanness that's dependent on, you know, comparing ourselves against someone else. My favorite one is, you know, if I said that I was, you know, I'm not a particularly good basketball player, then you could ask, compared to what? Compared to Michael Jordan, I'm pretty lousy. Compared to a 7-year-old kid, I'm, you know, Michael Jordan. The notion is comparative. And who do you choose to compare yourself with when you say, I'm not a good basketball player? I'm not a good this or good that. Or I am a good this or good that. So I met this woman about a week ago who for a while was talking to me about her difficulties in her life and how she was using mindfulness practice for it all. And it all seemed very nice, the conversation, for a while. Until after we talked for maybe an hour or so, I got this sense that she was trapped inside of comparative thinking, inside her personal story, and inside her personal story, how she is in relationship to everybody else. She was, her whole world that she was swimming in and living in was only a world of being in personal relationships with other people that was comparative thinking. And she was only concerned about process with other, this person is doing this and I'm doing this and I don't understand this and now our conversation, you know, what's really going on here. And I felt like she was trapped inside this world, very personal world of comparative thinking. And I think what's required of us as we do Buddhist practice is to find some ability to step outside of the personal, outside of the world of conventions, outside of the world that's constantly measuring ourselves against other people and other standards. So to see ourselves as, to live ourselves as human beings, rather than to see ourselves as a rich person or a poor person or a tall person or a short person or whatever. So part of this is to discover a mode of being, a mode of knowing, of living, that's unswayed by the shifting conventions of life, by the shifting things we can measure ourselves against. So to have a kind of a state of being or a mode of knowing that's unswayed by, for example, our age, our health, our status, our recognition, our praise, the blame that we get, success and the success and failure we have, to find some place to rest, to find some place within us, perhaps, that is a refuge, that doesn't matter if the conventions around us change, if the qualities, the quality conditions of life, the conditions of our life change. Because Buddhism teaches over and over and over again, you know, and you've heard it many times, that all the conditions of our life are constantly changing and they're not so reliable. If they're not reliable, then if we depend on them for our happiness, we're depending on something which might or might not last for very long. So there are many conditions in life that we kind of get preoccupied with as being, this is really important, I need to kind of hang on to this or I need to do something about it. So our health is a condition that comes and goes. The energy we have in our life, our physical fitness, our social relationships, our living conditions, our secure job or future, our wealth can come and go. All the kind of things people measure the quality of their life by, when it's external, all those things can be taken away from you. And life offers no guarantee that any of these things are going to remain. But a spiritual life is offering, a Buddhist life is offering a kind of well-being, a kind of security in a kind of way of knowing how to live a life that's not going to be swayed as those conditions change. So that we can get sick and maybe even start dying, and our well-being is not tied to anything at all. And that's a very radical thing to say. And I hope that's a very challenging thing for me to say. For you to kind of reflect and think, what are the conditions of my life that I'm depending on? And is there a different way of being? Is there a different way of knowing life that will be unswayed by all these changing conditions? And sometimes it's a blessing to have the conditions of our life, have the rug pulled out from under us, to have the stock market crash 97%, not just, what was it, 5% on Monday? I don't know, 7? Or to get sick, and, you know, a major illness in life, or to have something major happen to your life that really wakes you up to the fact of how much you're holding on to something and how maybe it's not necessary. And it happens to some people that actually their particular conditions of their life actually survive until they die. And they never actually get the opportunity to see where they're holding on, because things are basically kind of comfortable. And that's fine, but they never really plummet to the depth of the true nature of themselves, the full potential of freedom that's within them. So mindfulness practice can and often does provide some improvement in the quality of our life. We get more peaceful, less stressful, it relieves our stress and all this. However, if we're preoccupied with using a mindfulness practice simply to change the conditions of our life, the quality of our life, to move the furniture around, we're not really using the practice to its full potential. And the heart of Buddhist practice is not to directly improve the quality of life, but rather to discover the unconditional aspects of life. Unconditional in that they don't depend on conditions, they're not swayed by the changing conditions. So the unconditional aspects of awareness itself. To discover that awareness in its rawness, the naked awareness itself, is unswayed by conditions. Doesn't matter what happens to you, but if you rest in the knowing and awareness, there's a kind of tremendous freedom because it's unswayed. The unconditioned aspects of love, the unconditioned aspects of compassion, of freedom, of attention. So those are the three models of the path. And there's a way in which, in the history of Buddhism, these have been in tension with each other. And they've been in tension for thousands of years, for a long time, maybe from the beginning. And some schools and some teachers will insist that one of the ways is the truth, and the other way is not the truth. And what's interesting, I think, when you have a tension and conflict like this, which lasts for that long, that maybe the conflict is not in what's true and what's false, but rather it's three different points of view or perspectives of the same thing. Or it's actually all three are true. And we have to hold them all three together. So in order to live a life that has no path, which means to live a life that's free of all comparative thinking, it helps if you do some letting go. So to let go helps you settle into this world that doesn't need to anything. But letting go, you know, as maybe Pesha, I don't know what was behind Pesha's concern, but maybe I could imagine someone like Pesha, when she asked the question, it was distress. You know, wait a minute, I don't want to let go of all these things. They're perfectly reasonable to hold on to my whatever, fill in the blank. It's completely reasonable to be completely attached, right? So there's a lot of fear and insecurity. So in order to fully let go, it's very helpful to develop strong qualities of patience, of courage, of energy, of mindfulness, of compassion, of self-knowledge and understanding. And the more you develop those qualities, the easier it is to let go and the easier it is to rest in the fact that there's nothing to develop. Isn't that nice? My favorite way of understanding the path in Buddhism is that there is a path. There are things you can do and things you can develop. However, we hold that idea of path as we follow it, we're held in the palm of the Buddha. As in the palm of Buddha means we're already fine. We're already children of the Buddha. We're already complete as we are. There's no need to do anything. We're already loved for who we are. Or another way of saying this, we hold the idea of a path within the perspective that things are already perfect, that there is no path. Does that make sense? So we're following a path, we're willing to let ourselves develop concentration, develop our mindfulness so it becomes stronger, but we're not fooled. We don't think that we have to. We don't think that we're going to be a better person because we do. We don't think that we become more spiritual because we do. It's just a nice, you know, it's just what we do as human beings. You know, and so our feeling of self-worth, our sense of success as a human being, is not dependent on any progress we make in the path. And that, I think, is one of the great insights that comes with enlightenment, is that our fundamental self-worth as a human being is not dependent on making any spiritual progress. So let's go out and make some progress. Yes?
I just want to bring people's attention to, because I chanced upon it driving home, on NPR between 5:30 and 6:30 in the evening, they're having this whole week long a special on death and dying, especially in American culture, how we look at death. And today they interviewed two doctors who work with terminally ill people. And then the third person was actually a minister who focuses on hospice work. And it was very cool because one of the questions that Linda, I can't think of her last name, she's well known on NPR, she asked them separately was how it's different for people. Like I can't remember exactly the question, but how some people are able to let help. For some people, it's easier, and other people, it isn't. And it was very cool to hear, like doctors, mainstream, science doctors talk about how people with spirituality are, the people that sort of went out in a way. And also how that's true for their families, because the emphasis is on not just on the individual that's dying, but a big part of on the family too. And so it was really enlightening to hear that, and that also that the focus in medical care is being put on, more and more, especially with terminally ill patients and baby boomers moving into, getting older and thinking about death, is that this one Dr. Guy said that that science is really, that the real science is really the looking at it in terms of the spirituality or the palliative. So it was very thought provoking, and also, I think reinforces.
So 5:30 to 6:30. Thank you. Yeah, that spiritual practice is a preparation for dying.
Yeah.
So I see the polling people have come. So it would be nice if today we didn't linger too much, so that they can come in and start their preparation. Thank you.